From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's a part of the Independent Producer Project, and today we're going to listen to a program originally produced a couple of years ago, featuring long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad. What exactly happens to your brain when you swim for over 2 days straight?
You are truly left alone with your own thoughts. After a while, your left brain doesn't function anymore. You're over in your dream state, right brain, and it's kind of like you're watching yourself dream.
We have an uneasy relationship with the ocean, but despite the dangers, despite the vast size, despite the very unknowingness of the ocean, and probably because of it, we want to go back in. Look at surfers, for example. Surfers have made something of a religion around being in the ocean. No one dances with the power and the danger of the ocean like a surfer.
My name is Greg Rochelle. I'm president of the Black Surfing Association.
Surfers get to see a side of the ocean, of a wave, that others can't. And when it happens just right, it's so amazing that you never forget it.
I do remember the first time I got in the tube on a wave, yeah.
It's the tube, the barrel, the shack, the green room, the keg, the pit, the womb. It's one of the coolest things you can do in surfing.
What it is, the waves, sometimes they kind of fold on each other, but sometimes if the wind is right, the wave actually makes a hollow tube as it breaks down the line. And you can actually ride inside of that. You pop up and you're just in the perfect spot on the board, the perfect spot on the wave, and everything's clicking and it happens.
You've got the wave crashing behind you, water above and around you.
It makes a hollow noise. It cuts out the sound. I mean, it's indescribable. I remember I was surfing with my buddy, 3 or 4 feet, maybe about head high, the waves are, and I took off on this wave, and as I made the turn at the bottom of the wave, I looked, and the wave was peeling over my head, and I looked, and he was paddling over the shoulder of the wave and looking at me inside the wave at the same time. It was pretty special, and I still remember it, you know, like it was yesterday.
It only lasts for a few seconds, but it's perfect.
You're chasing that feeling for the rest of your life.
What is this power that the ocean has over us? What does it do to us? How does it change us? Today on Unfictional, it's an episode called The Wound. But unlike Greg Rochelle, the surfer, swimmer Diana Nyad had a relationship with the ocean not measured in seconds, but in hours and hours and hours. You probably know that on this past Labor Day, Diana finally completed her lifelong dream of swimming from Havana, Cuba to Key West, Florida, about 110 miles over 2 full days in the water, swimming. Listeners to KCRW know that for several years, Diana was the host of a sports commentary segment called The Score. And one day, back in the fall of 2009, we were in the studio, and Diana told me that she would be stopping her commentary to begin training for a long-distance swim, and this was long after she had stopped doing this sort of thing. But she had turned 60 years old at this time, and she was determined to complete the Cuba to Florida swim that she had unsuccessfully attempted back in 1978. And when Diana told me this, I said something like, "Wow, that's incredible, good luck, amazing." But inside, I was thinking, that is completely nuts. That's impossible. I admire her for having that level of confidence in her abilities, but there is no freaking way that somebody, especially somebody who's 60 years old, could do something like that. But then I heard about her training regimen that featured 8-hour daily swims and the team of navigators and weather people and doctors and shark-watching kayakers, and I started thinking, this thing sounds real. Diana knows what she's doing. And so, in early August 2011, I was fortunate to be invited to be on the Friends boat that would meet Diana's flotilla of support boats about halfway through her journey, and we would help cheer her on to the end.
There you are. See you in 2 days.
Likewise.
shore.
We left Key West in the late afternoon and sailed as the sun set on the Florida Strait, with all of Diana's friends excited and in awe, like Jean Gold. She was on the Friends boat with me, and she compared Diana to a mythological character.
It is an epic thing, and it's, and at the same time, it's anchored in her humanness, you know. If you talk about a female hero today, you talk about a heroine, but the truth is that Hera was a woman. Hera is the Greek mythological character that Leander swam to across the Hellespont. I mean, here we are, crossing the Hellespont to see her. She's a hero to so many people.
But that night, just before 1 a.m., the captain heard over the radio that Diana had been pulled from the water. An asthma attack had cut the swim short. A month and a half later, she tried again, but was pushed off course and stung by jellyfish. The next summer, she tried again and made it farther than she ever had, but the swim was ended by storms and more brutal jellyfish stings. And then finally, this last summer, she made her fifth and final attempt at the Cuba to Florida swim. The operation was tighter now, the crew trained and experienced. Diana was wearing special protection from the jellyfish that covered part of her face. She wore gloves and swim boots, but all of this added weight that she had to carry through the swim. And so it turned out that someone 60 years old couldn't complete this swim, but someone who was 64 could. This is a story produced before that first attempt in 2011 about what happens to your mind when you swim day and night for hours and hours and hours. I'm Bob Carlson, and from KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
I still don't, outside the ocean, go to the meaning of the universe. The beginnings of the universe. Was there a beginning? Or does time and space exist unto infinity? There was never a beginning. It's always been here. There will never be an end. You know, is there something that I don't understand from physics? Are there black holes that surround the edge of the universe and there just isn't anything? There's no more matter once you go to a certain distance. I'm not sure that humankind will ever have the answers to these questions, but there's something about, especially at night, traveling across the quiet of the ocean's surface. You're wearing a fogged-over pair of goggles. You're turning your head 60 times a minute toward a boat that you're following that's over, in my case, on the left. And I can't really focus on anything. Even when I come in to stop to get some feeding, you know, I can't touch the boat, but I can come over close and reach out and get a sports drink or a slab of peanut butter or something. I look up and just vaguely see the outline of a friend there, and it's only the voice that I recognize. I don't hear too well while swimming. You know, I've got four or five tight rubber bathing caps over my ears. All you're hearing is kind of that deep, you know, odd kind of sound of your own breath, you know, sort of magnified by the water and the transference of sound in the water. And my arms and my kick, you know, slapping and kicking along the surface. I remember back in, you know, my heyday, which was the 70s when I was in my 20s, if I'd, let's say, go on, you know, the Tonight Show, Johnny Carson, the first primary question he would ask is, why? It looks so uncomfortable. There doesn't look like anything fun about it. Last year, after not swimming for 30-some years, went down to Mexico to do my first training swim. Very cold day, cold water. I was just freezing when I got out, and my friends I was staying with ran me a hot, hot bath. And it took me a while. It took me like 3 hours to get my body temperature back up. And there was a little 5-year-old girl in the house. And she came and she sat on the edge of the tub, and she didn't bother me. She saw I was in distress. But just like Johnny Carson, she looked and she was puzzled, and finally she asked me, why? You are truly left alone with your own thoughts. And I've had neurologists study me, and there are other swimmers who will talk about this too, that say that after a while, your left brain just doesn't function anymore. Your left brain isn't, you know, thinking those concrete thoughts that we think, the things that control language and math. You're not there anymore. You're over in your dream state, right brain. And it's kind of like you're watching yourself dream. You're having hallucinations. I had a time in Argentina in a long swim years ago back in the 70s where I thought, and I remember it very clearly, I was in the moment. I thought a flock of gulls were dive bombing and attacking with their beaks my forehead, like literally ripping or shredding into the rubber of my bathing cap and bringing up blood and tissue from my forehead. And I was in a panic. I was diving under. I was swatting them above me. And I told my people on the boat, you know, help me, help me. You know, get these birds away from me. And I was just, I was in absolute fear. Well, they told me later that they had two choices. They could come over closer with the boat and try to reason with me and tell me that there were no birds at all. Nobody was dive bombing me. Take a look. Put my hand across my forehead. See, there's no blood. The bathing cap is intact. This was not happening. But that, they figured, was going to take them too long because I was in a race. I was trying to beat other people to the other end. So they came over and got the two oars up from the boat and started swatting these birds. They went along with me. And they yelled at them and they shooed them away. And, you know, in just a real short time, like 10 seconds, I said, oh, thank God that's over. Don't worry, they're all gone. I said, oh, thank you. Thank you for helping me. And then, of course, I think of my own name. You know, I grew up, I had a father named Aristotle Zenith Naiad. He was a Greek-Egyptian, actually, but his father was a Greek. And the name Naiad, perhaps you know this already, but it means water nymph. In the Greek mythology, the water nymphs that swam in the sea were the naiads. They protected the seas for the gods. And here I am, this ocean swimmer who became a real naiad. People have asked me, you know, do you feel more at home in the ocean than out? And I have to say that I do. It's not like it's sheer pleasure to get in and go all those long hours and to feel cold and to feel aches and pains and discomfort to keep on going. But when I relax, and again, somehow for me, it's special, especially at nighttime. So that ocean is my home for that time, and all the long, long hours and many months of training. When I walk into the sea, I have to say that there's something that envelops me, like here I am, the naiad of the sea, going home. So, you know, you go to all these places, but if your body's not happy, if you're struggling with your body, then your mind is not happy either. And it's, you can't let go and free associate. You can't even stay in the moment and count off songs. If I sing a short ditty that I can remember that just gets me through about, you know, 40 strokes, it's very comforting. I know the tune. I kind of hear it in my ears, even though I'm not singing aloud. You know, I'm just singing in my mind. But when I finish that little ditty, I'll say one. Then I'll sing it again. And I might sing it 5,000 times, literally, and I won't lose count. When I get to like number 3,248, I don't lose count after and say, oh my, wait a second, was that 2,458 or 200? No, I don't lose count for 5,000 hits, and it keeps my mind engaged, and it helps me pass the time. And other times, I can't help it. My mind won't focus on something that specific, won't stay in that counting, and it'll go off. It'll go off into the wild blue yonder, so to speak. Each time I get in, I think, what am I going to think about? What am I going to program my mind to think about for all these hours? and it's not easy. And that's what gets to me also. If I'm in the middle of a swim and I'm having trouble, you know, occasionally it's a physical thing. You feel nauseous and you're literally vomiting in the ocean, and then you've got to do something to get that stomach under control. Sometimes the shoulders are just, you know, on fire from so much stress and pressing, especially if there have been a lot of waves. Or, you know, the legs can get so tight that you just can barely stay in that supine position anymore. The neck from turning the head so many times. There are things you have to, you know, address, get through. But for me, that's nothing compared to the mind. If I just can't do it. I just stop during a training swim and say, I'm going to go insane if I have to, you know, if I've got to swim 5 more hours, you know, how am I going to keep my mind, you know, interested in something? That's the hardship, I think. You know, once you've got the body ready, taking the mind through all those hours when you have nothing but your mind, you know, to entertain you is, I find it very difficult. I don't think there's any way to train for it. You just get ready and get out there and see if you can make it through. For me, I grew up in Florida, right on the ocean. That Greek father that I mentioned used to wake us up, my brother and sister and I, at 3 o'clock in the morning some nights. And he'd say, "Kids, get up quickly. Throw on a coat. Get on your slippers. We got to go to the beach. There's a full moon tonight, and it's casting gorgeous shadows across the ocean and light, sparkling light for miles to the horizon." And we'd say, "Dad, we have school in the morning. We can't get up." And he'd say, "This is more important than school. This is larger than life." As he was. He was larger than life. And the ocean was part of it. He had a tremendous love for the sea. And so it is my home. The ocean is my home. I'm afraid of it. I'm respectful of it. I bow to it. And I'm at home in it.
On the afternoon of September 2nd, 2013, Diana Nyad walked onto the beach at Key West, Florida, about 53 hours after beginning her swim from Havana, Cuba.
We should never, ever give up.
You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and today on the program, The Womb, Stories of the Ocean, What It Does to Us, How It Changes Us. In the first part of this program, we heard from a couple of people who are true believers. They've got a real devotion to the sea. But we close the program with a story from an ocean agnostic. Writer Dave White. He's never had an interest in relaxing by the sea, even though he lives in a city right next to the ocean. Los Angeles. Dave White has been on this program a couple of times before, and today he's got a story about the time he was forced to make his peace with going to the beach.
We were going to find that stretch of Malibu that David Geffen once tried to declare off limits to the public. That to be my first beach experience in Los Angeles. But I ended up at El Matador instead, with a dozen gay guys. My first time at a beach in nearly 10 years of living here. There are reasons that I waited. the first one is that I just don't believe in the sun. I don't want to bathe in it. I don't want it to kiss me. I want to punch it in the face and for my ghostly white skin to stay cancerless. I don't wear shorts. I don't wear flip-flops. I don't wear sleeveless t-shirts. Meteorologically speaking, I'm kind of a goth, minus the attachment to those black velvet blouses and The Nightmare Before Christmas and stinky incense. The other reason I'd lived here for nearly a decade without going near a beach is that I had to be reminded to care. I didn't move to Southern California to hang with the kids from the hills, or do the surf and bird, or catch a wave, or have Katy Perry spray whipped cream on me from her boobs. I'm not super into nature or being outside. Indoor book-like activities are great. Lying down on a couch, I'm better suited to those kinds of things. And I probably sound like a neurotic New York transplant right now, but I'm not that either. I'm from Texas, and I stayed inside there too, just kind of as a survival skill. It's about 1 million degrees there all the time is why. The other thing, the water is poison. People here pretend it's not so they can enjoy their day on the shore, but it is. And I thought that before those jackasses ruined the entire southern coast of the United States. I've watched enough local news to understand that, along with daily home invasions and murder-suicides in bedroom communities, there's always some rotting animal carcass washing up on shore or a university scientist uncovering some toxic bacteria in the water that'll crawl straight up your urethra if you get in the water for more than 3 seconds. My chaperones, unfortunately, did not indulge my scientific knowledge. Now, I already told you that these were gay guys, but you're going to have to erase your ideas of what that means at a beach. I'm not talking about the square-cut, Speedo-wearing, six-pack abs torso brand of gay, where the towel matches the sunglasses. If they had been, I might have been left alone under an umbrella with a magazine and a drink. But these were the bears. I don't know if I have to explain what that is or not, but I'll do it anyway. They're this little micro-universe inside the world's supply of gays. And to say it politely, they're big guys. The kind of gays with bellies and beards and back hair. And they don't care. And this particular batch of bears were the kind that like to body surf and play rowdy tackle frisbee. The kind who think it's fun to try to drown each other in 3 feet of surf. My friends are not the sort of people who leave you alone. Come in the water, Dave White, hollers my friend Gary, who always uses both my first and last name like I'm Charlie Brown. He's already diving in, frisbee ready to launch at whoever happens to be standing nearby. It's freezing! No, I said, the ocean has AIDS. Come in, this AIDS is awesome! I stand my ground for a little bit and I cover myself with 50 SPF. It's this sunblock from France. You buy it online, and it's like mind-shreddingly expensive. There's some kind of ingredient that's not FDA approved. I think it's technically maybe illegal to sell it in the United States. But I read an article where this fancy dermatologist recommended it, and she probably gets a kickback from the company, but I believed every word, and I buy some every summer. Then I put on a hat, covered the rest of myself in a towel, and I read Us Weekly until I was ready to take on the doom water. I look up at Gary, who is literally frolicking in the water. I couldn't think of a time in my life when I'd actually seen someone just jumping around and behaving in what you'd call a frolicking manner before. It was always just a dictionary word until I watched him doing it. He kind of looked like a spazzy four-year-old, another thing the beach was full of, but at least the water seemed like it might be okay. Parents were letting their actual spazzy four-year-olds in it, so no one's arms or legs appeared to be dissolving on contact. An hour passed. I finished my magazine. I got up and walked toward the surf, just in time to be bonked in the face by Gary's frisbee. A seemingly titanium object that broke the skin, drew blood, and left a blazing red dent in my forehead. This injury was greeted with shouts of woohoo from my so-called friends, all of whom are jerks. I stayed in the water, touching my wound just to prove I was a man, thinking about bacteria and shrinkage and jaws, for about 5 minutes, and then I got out. It was time for lunch. These guys brought fried chicken from Ralph's, a gigantic chocolate cake, also donuts, also bread. Gays who don't care about their abs are the best providers. After lunch, I think my internal scales tipped somewhere. I got back in the water a little while more, realized it wasn't going to devour me, got tackled, got water up my nose, failed at body surfing, and then I got out again, because I had put in my time. Not enough to avoid being mocked for months afterward, but enough for me. The rest of the afternoon, I sat just sort of sleepily looking at the waves. The heat from the sand and the fried chicken in my belly were inspiring me to nod off. And I realized, for the first time, why people want to live at the beach and just look at the ocean for hours. It's like heroin, but cheaper. Except for the part where you have to buy that beach house. And then, like on cue, dolphins showed up. Late in the afternoon, right as we were about to pack it in, a whole gang of them swimming north. Now, I don't know if this is a common occurrence around here, but because they're smart and most likely sensed that every single eye on the sand was now watching and pointing at them yelling, "Look, dolphins!" they began leaping out of the water in those perfect dolphin arcs. Dolphins are so great. They're almost as good as dogs and monkeys. Once you see them wild and doing their thing, you realize why water parks like to turn them into performing slaves. It's almost their own fault for being so stupid awesome. Thanks to my tendency to anthropomorphize animals, I decided right there that the dolphins had shown up for my benefit, and they wanted me to love the beach and being outside. And I will say that my tolerance for being in a heavily shaded outdoor space grew 1.5 sizes that day. Only Jane Wiedlin in a body glove wetsuit riding one of those dolphins' backs and singing Rush Hour could have made it better. So when I buy a big umbrella and we go back, and that's coming up again really soon if I have my way, I'd like it if someone could arrange for her to do that. In fact, she might actually know where David Geffen lives.
Dave White is the author of Exile in Guyville and a contributor to the anthology Love is a Four-Letter Word. He's the film critic for Movies.com and co-host of the Linoleum Knife podcast. His new book, Keep It Heavy, Man, comes out in 2014. You can find photos and other information at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, and you can find a growing archive of all the episodes of the program there, too. You can like the show on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Unfictional. You can podcast this show on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Nick White. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Production assistants from Monica Scott. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support. And I hope you'll join me next week for Unfictional from KCRW.com.